Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants will be on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's meeting. At that time, to ask a question from the phone line, please press star 1 and record your name and media outlet when prompted. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to your host, Monica Nation. You may begin.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you so much for joining this special media call to take a deeper dive into the coral bleaching event that is unfolding in and along Florida's coral reef. I'm Monica Allen with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. If you have additional questions after the conclusion of today's call, please email me at monica.allen, A-L-L-E-N, Monica with a C, at NOAA.gov, or my public affairs colleagues who have been assisting with this, Kate Silverstein at Catherine, K-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E, dot S-I-L-V-E-R-S-T-E-I-N, at NOAA.gov, or John Jones Bateman at NESDIS, N-E-S-D-I-S, dot P-A, at NOAA.gov. Today's update will begin with opening remarks from Dr. Steve Thur, NOAA Assistant Administrator for Oceanic and Atmospheric Research. Dr. Thur has a long history with coral, serving as the Director of the Coral Program at NOAA's National Ocean Service. Dr. Thur took the helm as NOAA Assistant Administrator for Research last year. Following Dr. Thur's remarks, you will also hear from our experts. And this is the panel of experts that you will hear from. You will hear from Dr. Derek Manzello, the coordinator of the NOAA Coral Reef Watch Program, Dr. Ian Enox, research ecologist at NOAA's Atlantic, Oceanographic, and Meteorological Laboratory, Dr. Andy Bruckner, research coordinator at NOAA's Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary. A copy of the slide deck presentation for our speakers can be downloaded now if you haven't done it already. Go to this link, noaa.research.gov, and you'll be able to scroll down and see a story titled Media Resources, Deeper Dive into Coral Bleaching, and at the top of that, you will see a link to view slides or to download them. So I encourage you to do that because our speakers will be referring to those slides, telling you which page they're on, and it'll be easier for you to understand the presentations. Following our four speakers, we will have a Q&A for the media. With that, I would like to turn the mic over to Dr. Steve Thur.
Good day, everyone. My name is Steve Thur, and I'm the Assistant Administrator for Oceanic and Atmospheric Research. Today, we're very pleased to present a panel of coral experts from across different components of NOAA who will help you to understand this summer's coral bleaching event affecting one of our nation's largest coral reefs, which is located mostly within the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary. Coral reefs in Florida and around the world are vitally important to human and natural communities. They are also on the front lines of climate change impacts. Teeming with diverse marine life, coral reefs provide nurseries for valuable fisheries that feed millions and provide jobs to those in our coastal communities. They draw tourists to boost our economy. They're important to the cultural heritage of communities on our coasts, and they protect coastal areas by reducing the power of waves hitting the coast during hurricanes and severe storms. The science and stewardship activities needed to understand and protect our amazing marine resources, including coral reefs, is conducted across NOAA. Earlier in my career, I managed NOAA's Coral Reef Conservation Program, which supports some of the work that you will hear about in this call. Coral reef science and conservation is deeply personal to me, and I've been associated with coral reef research since I was an undergraduate student 25 years ago. I am truly sobered by the impacts of the current marine heat wave on Florida's reefs. During my 20 years with NOAA's National Ocean Service, I was fortunate to work with dedicated coral scientists to develop the National Coral Reef Monitoring Program. That was the first nationwide effort to integrate physical, biological, and human community monitoring to help us understand a clearer picture of coral status and the threats they face. The work that's been undertaken in the Florida Keys over the past couple of decades allows us to place the scale and impact of this current event into a broader context. As climate change continues to impact our marine ecosystems and the communities that rely on them, the work that NOAA does across the agency and with a wide variety of partners from government, academia, the private sector, and non-governmental organizations is more important than ever. Now, I'd like to turn this over to Dr. Derek Manzello, our first speaker.
Thank you very much, Dr. Thur. I'm going to be starting on slide number 2, and today I'm going to highlight the current coral bleaching level heat stress patterns in Florida, as well as the wider Caribbean and Eastern Pacific. First, let me orient you to the map and graphs on slide 2. A map of Florida in the top right is showing you our bleaching alert area product for the region. The bleaching alert area product simplifies our coral bleaching prediction algorithm such that all light red areas are where there is heat stress that is known to elicit significant coral bleaching, and the dark reds are where there is sufficient heat stress to cause severe bleaching and coral mortality. The light red corresponds to an alert level 1, and the dark red corresponds to an alert level 2. I will refer to these alert levels multiple times. As you can see, all of the Florida Keys and most of Southeast Florida is experiencing alert level 2 conditions. The plots in the bottom right summarize the data from our Florida Keys and Southeast Florida regional virtual stations. These plots are showing two things. First, the multiple different colored lines at the top are the daily average sea surface temperatures for every year in the satellite record. Second, the lines at the bottom of the plot show the accumulation of degree heating weeks for each year. Degree heating weeks are our primary metric for estimating bleaching level heat stress. There are two dashed horizontal lines that indicate the degree heating week values whereby an alert level 1 and 2 are generated. The black lines are the data from 2023. Some key points about these plots. Daily average temperatures have been record-setting for both regions. In the Florida Keys, sea temperatures broke the previous record for the highest value ever measured by satellite on July 9th, and temperatures have been higher than the prior record for 28 of the past 37 days. You can see this pattern in both graphs, as the 2023 black line of sea temperatures is clearly much higher than anything ever recorded. The onset of this heat stress started earlier than ever before. We need to bear in mind that there have already been 8 mass coral bleaching events that have impacted the Florida Keys since 1987. During past events, temperatures didn't reach bleaching level heat stress, and bleaching wasn't observed until mid-August. If you look at the bottom of these plots, it's clear that the accumulation of heat stress started earlier than ever before on record. The Florida Keys virtual station has been at an alert level 2 since July 16th and hit an alert level 1 on July 6th. What this means is that this bleaching event started a full 5 to 6 weeks earlier than the previous 8 mass bleaching events that have impacted Florida. In summary, we hear the word unprecedented thrown around all the time, but allow me to qualify that word with the facts. First, Florida's corals have never been exposed to this magnitude of heat stress. Second, this heat occurred earlier than ever before. A big concern is that temperatures are reaching their seasonal peak right now, so this stress is likely to persist for at least the next month. Thus, these corals will experience heat stress that is not only higher than ever before, earlier than ever before, but for longer in duration than ever before. This is a key point because the impacts to corals is a function of how high the heat stress is and how long it lasts. Moving on to slide number 3, unfortunately, Florida is just the tip of the iceberg and is just one location that is being impacted by this large-scale heat stress event that is impacting coral reefs in both the eastern tropical Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. In the top left is the year-to-date bleaching alert area product for the Caribbean region and Eastern Pacific. As you can see, large areas of the Eastern Tropical Pacific have experienced alert level 2 conditions. In the bottom left, you can see an image of a completely bleached reef off of the Mexican Pacific, as well as the multi-year temperature and degree heating weeks data for this site. Again, there is a similar pattern to Florida in that heat stress began accumulating earlier than ever before and has reached values that have never before been achieved. Now let's look at the data from Bocas del Toro, which is on the Caribbean side of Panama. Multiple investigators began observing severe bleaching here in early July and began sending us pictures and reports. In the picture here is a Acropora cervicornis or staghorn coral, which is listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. Unfortunately, all the non-white bleached portions of these colonies are recent heat-driven mortality. Finally, the top right shows data specific to the coral reef climate change sentinel monitoring site in the Florida Keys that Ian Enox will discuss later. Moving on to slide 4, we have confirmed bleaching in 5 countries bordering the Eastern Pacific, off Mexico, El Salvador, Costa Rica, Panama, and Colombia. In the Atlantic, there is confirmed bleaching in at least 7 countries and territories that includes Florida, both sides of the Yucatan Peninsula off Mexico, Belize, Cuba, Panama, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Moving on to slide 5, not only does Coral Reef Watch monitor heat stress in near real time, but we also produce a 4-month coral bleaching outlook product. This forecast is model-based and utilizes NOAA's climate forecast system to provide weekly updates about possible future heat stress. The Outlook product predicts that the Caribbean will continue to warm, such that the majority of the Caribbean is predicted to experience alert-level conditions within the next 1 to 2 weeks. Alert Level 2 conditions are predicted to occur for the entire Caribbean by mid-September and persist through October. For Florida in particular, the heat stress is not expected to dissipate until mid to late September or early October. This means we may be looking at an additional month of heat stress in Florida. I will add one caveat here. This is not a prophecy written on stone tablets. Things can change. Specifically, the Outlook product does not do a good job at predicting hurricanes and tropical storms. Tropical cyclones do a very good job at dissipating and redistributing the heat in the ocean, and they cause significant cooling of coral reef environments. Thus, if Atlantic hurricane activity starts spinning up, these predictions may change. Moving on to slide 6, the key take-home points are as follows. There is a large-scale heat stress and coral bleaching event underway spanning 2 ocean basins and multiple countries. Sea surface temperatures in the Atlantic are currently as high or higher than they've ever been in the satellite record, and heat stress has accumulated earlier than ever before. Unfortunately, Florida appears to be the location that is being most severely impacted by this large-scale marine heat wave. Pretty much every coral in Florida is experiencing alert level 2 conditions. Some sites in the Florida Keys are experiencing accumulated heat stress that is 2 times greater than when we expect mortality to begin. Unless we have significant changes in weather patterns and development of tropical storms and hurricanes, we are marching towards a Caribbean-wide heat stress event within a matter of days to weeks. I'd now like to turn over the floor to Dr. Ian Enox.
Thank you, Derek. And before I begin, Monica Allen has asked that I make a minor correction. The location of the materials to follow along, the slides to follow along, are at research.noaa.gov. That's research.noaa.gov. With that, I'd like to focus really on, move to, well, one slide, slide 7, and also to Chica Rocks, which is within the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary. And this is a patch reef off of the coast of Isla Mirada. Please move to slide 8. This is a particularly resilient site historically we've seen with high coral cover. It has been selected as one of NOAA's climate monitoring sites as part of the National Coral Reef Monitoring Program. And associated with that, we have been with some frequency measuring the concentration of carbon dioxide within water and atmosphere, as well as the temperature, as well as the various ecological and physiological responses to those parameters. And we've been doing this really for more than a decade, collecting those data, producing ultimately numerous scientific publications that have advanced our understanding of how reefs respond to climate, but also pushing our understanding forward in terms of management scenarios that can be used to address these issues. This reef has also been selected as one of the 7 sites selected as part of the Mission Iconic Reefs as a restoration site. And I mention all of these things to you because I think they really highlight the importance and value of this reef, both from a societal and economic perspective, but also an ecological, biological, biodiversity perspective. And also really from a scientific perspective in terms of all of the understanding that we've taken from this. Please move to slide 9. And so with that background, I want to show you these data here of really how high the temperature has been. As Derek mentioned very well, we have been very much above the bleaching threshold of this site. These data come from a climate monitoring buoy that we have at the site. You can see that we reached a peak of roughly 93 degrees Fahrenheit, which is well in excess of, as Derek mentioned, what corals are normally able to deal with. As a result, you can see this photo on the right with nearly complete bleaching of the corals that are there. This is not what a reef is supposed to look like. Please move to slide 10. Now, as part of the National Coral Reef Monitoring Program, one of the things we do, like I said, is to really monitor these reefs quite closely. And while these may look like individual images, these are actually constructions, three-dimensional constructions from thousands of digital images each. And these allow us to monitor the health and growth of individual corals. And we've been doing this for over 10 years. So we have a really good understanding of what these corals have dealt with through time. On June 30th, you can see here on the left, a healthy coral reef, lots of color, lots of beautiful corals present there. And roughly 3 weeks later, on July 24th, here on the right, you can see it's an entirely different scene. So much bleaching, so much paling. Now, I'd like to move to slide 11, please. This is a close-up, if you will, of from those same images. The dark blue arrows point to, on the left, point to healthy coral cover. These are the corals that provide all of the structure, all of the habitats, all of the ecosystem services that Dr. Thur was mentioning earlier. And on the right, again, you can see them bleached, stark white, or paling. The light blue arrows below actually point to soft corals. These are sea fans and sea whips that also have numerous ecological services and ecosystem services associated with them. On the left, again, we see healthy individuals, and on the right, they are unfortunately already dead. Many are disintegrating and falling apart, even with the conditions that they're already experiencing. I'd like to move to slide 12 now, please. So the Atlantic Oceanographic and Meteorological Laboratory and the coral program there is focused on several solution-driven science and technology research tracks. So we are looking at performance assessment, whereby we look at the various capabilities of different coral individuals. We want to know what these individuals are capable of dealing with so we can make informed decisions about where we place them on the reef based on what types of stress and degrees of stress that they're able to deal with. We're also developing technologies associated with automating various restoration approaches, specifically coral farming, so that we can hopefully increase the efficiency and of these efforts and decrease the overall costs. And finally, we're also working on stress hardening, using natural mechanisms to help coral individuals be able to deal with stress, greater degrees of stress for longer. And with that, I'd like to move the mic over to Dr. Andy Bruckner. Thank you.
Thank you, Ian. Hello, everyone. My name is Andy Bruckner. I am the research coordinator with NOAA's Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary. And what I want to do now is provide more of a brief overview of what we're seeing on the reefs throughout the Florida Keys and talk a little bit about some of the actions the sanctuary and our partners are taking to minimize the impacts of this event. For those of you that are not familiar with the Florida Keys, please refer to slide 13. Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary covers an area of about 3,800 square miles, and it extends 180 miles from Biscayne Bay just south of Miami to the Dry Tortugas. The sanctuary is home to over 6,000 species of marine organisms, and it contains the only barrier coral reef in North America. This bank barrier reef system supports thousands of jobs, it provides key sources of food, as well as revenue from tourism and fisheries, and it forms an important barrier that protects the shoreline from the full brunt of the storms. If you could move now to slide 14. In 2019, the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary kicked off Mission Iconic Reefs, which is one of the world's largest and most comprehensive coral restoration programs. This program aims to reestablish about 500,000 reproductively mature corals on the 7 iconic reefs that are shown in the illustration up in the top right. While thousands of corals have already been returned to the reef, as you're all aware, these corals are witnessing the most severe temperature stress event ever observed in Florida. If you now go to slide 15, last week, the sanctuary embarked on a sanctuary-wide research expedition to conduct a comprehensive bleaching assessment within the plots of restored elkhorn and staghorn corals throughout the 7 iconic reefs. The intent of this work is to compare the bleaching severity and coral survival among regions, reefs, habitats, the age of these outplants, the restoration method, as well as various biological attributes such as their genotype or genetic strain. So our surveys to date have really shown how variable the impacts from bleaching have been and how quickly the status of corals is changing. The first signs of stress were noted on these reefs in May and June when severe disease outbreaks began emerging within our shallow nurseries and also on the reef. By the end of June, there were some reefs that had also begun to bleach. Since this time, the extent of bleaching has increased throughout the sanctuary, with some reef locations and nursery sites witnessing bleaching followed by near total mortality of corals, and other locations exhibiting high levels of bleaching but much less mortality. And still, there are some hope spots. There are some locations to date that have exhibited very minimal signs of bleaching and little or no mortality. The other important point to note is that bleaching severity has varied by species, with many of the bolder corals, such as the Orbicella colony shown in the top right, resisting bleaching or only experiencing slight paling. The difference in bleaching that's been observed between reefs have tracked closely with the amount and duration of heat stress. If you look at the figure in the center, this graph illustrates the total number of consecutive days when the water temperature has remained above 88 degrees. That's the first set of bars. And then there's a series of four bars showing how many days each of those reefs, the temperatures exceeded anywhere from 86 to 93 degrees. And this is for 5 locations spread throughout the upper, middle, and lower Keys. Overall, the highest temperatures and the longest duration of temperature above the bleaching threshold has been recorded at the site Ian just mentioned, Chica Rocks. And this is followed by sites in the middle Keys around Sombrero and Marathon. While Carysport Reef, which is an offshore location in the upper Keys, it has actually remained cooler than other sites and has seen much less mortality. And the final thing I want to draw your attention to on this slide is that elkhorn coral that's shown in the lower right. Corals often show signs of partial bleaching, and typically what will happen is the upright portions of that coral that are exposed to the highest levels of light bleach first, while the undersides of these corals may retain their algae and their pigmentation. So ultimately, these top surfaces of these corals may die, and we've seen that in a lot of cases, but then the sides and the bases can survive, and those could actually resheet over that dead skeleton or continue growing as long as the temperature stress subsides. So moving now to slide 16. Over the last 3 weeks, oh, I'm sorry, my slides actually got reversed. The slide 17 somehow got moved before 16. So if you refer to slide 17 first, over the last 3 weeks, NOAA has been working with our restoration partners to relocate thousands of corals from shallow water nurseries. The first component is shown by a number one in the figure, involved a genetic rescue where approximately 150 elkhorn coral and 300 staghorn coral fragments. This represents every remaining unique genotype or genetic strain of these species that's known to exist on the reefs in Florida. These were relocated to Moat Aquaculture Park and the Reef Institute for Gene Banking. A second component involved relocating large branches of elkhorn coral to spawning facilities at Florida Aquarium, basically to increase the genetic diversity of their spawning stock. At the same time, the practitioners have been moving a substantial amount of their production stock from their in-water nurseries to land. So far, Moat has moved about 10,000 corals from 4 of their in-water nurseries, and CRF has moved about 4,000 corals from one of their in-water nurseries in Tavernier. And fourth, we have another restoration partner, Reef Renewal USA, which is taking a different approach. They've relocated about 2,800 corals from their shallow Tavernier nursery to an offshore location that's in about 70 feet depth, where water temperatures currently are about 2 degrees cooler than the shallow reefs. So for my last slide, which on this deck is number 16, I want to just provide a few comments on other activities that we are exploring to understand and address temperature stress. First, it's important to note that our partners are not relocating every single coral from their shallow water nurseries. Representative genetic strains or genotypes of every species are being maintained in these shallow water nurseries, basically to better understand how they perform, how the different genetic individuals perform under periods of high temperature. Second, the research cruise that I mentioned is going to be repeated in February 2024 to basically evaluate patterns of recovery to help identify sites that may be more resilient or less resilient to temperature stress, and also to identify those corals that resisted bleaching with the intent of collecting some of these to use in future propagation and restoration efforts. And then I just wanted to just briefly mention a little bit about what Ian discussed in terms of other research. Our federal, state, and academic partners are continuing to conduct research to identify and produce resilient corals through a variety of mechanisms, such as selective breeding, stress hardening, and symbiont shuffling. While many of these studies are showing promise, the largest challenge we face with this work right now is scaling this up so that we can produce enough resilient corals to meet our goals for restoration. And then finally, the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary and our partners are conducting some pilot interventions this year to both reduce the stress to corals. This includes things like trialing some small-scale shading experiments, focused removal of coral predators from outplanted corals, and improvements of habitat quality, both through the removal of nuisance species that compete with these corals and the reintroduction of herbivorous sea urchins and crabs. And so I just want to conclude by emphasizing this has been a Herculean effort for what's been done to date, and it's been very, very collaborative in nature. The engagement and the hard work of the dozens of partners has demonstrated the commitment, I think, of the Florida Keys community in working together to save Florida's beautiful coral reefs. And with that, I'm going to pass the microphone back to Monica.
Thank you, Andy, and to our other speakers as well, a big thanks. Now, joining us for the Q&A portion of the call are some additional NOAA experts, and I'm going to give you their names right now. Jennifer Koss, that's K-O-S-S, and Jennifer is the director of the NOAA Coral Reef Conservation Program. Dana Wusinic Mendez, and Dana's last name is spelled W-U-S-I-N-I-C-H hyphen M-E-N-D-E-Z, and Dana is the Atlantic and Caribbean team lead for the NOAA Coral Reef Conservation Program. Dr. Mark Ladd, who is the coral reef ecologist at the Southeast Fishery Science Center, Dr. Michael Jaycox, a research oceanographer at the Southwest Fisheries Science Center, Jameson Gove, research oceanographer at the Pacific Islands Fisheries Science Center, and Gerald Hoff, fisheries biologist at the Alaska Fisheries Science Center. We will now take specific questions from our call participants from journalists. Please be sure to identify yourself by name and your outlet. And also, if you want the question to go to a specific person, let us know. Operator, please remind the call participants how they can ask a question, and then please queue up the first question.
Absolutely.
While we are waiting for the questions to come in, I'd like to turn the mic over to Jennifer Koss with the Coral Reef Conservation Program to give us some important insight about NOAA's big picture conservation strategy. Jennifer?
Thank you very much, Monica, and thank you, Steve, Derek, Ian, and Andy, for capturing the immediacy and urgency of this event so well. It's hard to come up with a perfect analogy to put situations like this into context, but if you'll indulge me, we could think of NOAA's response to this marine heat wave and bleaching event as a battle that is part of a larger campaign to conserve and recover these valuable resources. In addition to these emergency actions, NOAA conducts many more research and management activities every day for the betterment of our nation's coral reefs. NOAA's Coral Reef Conservation Program efforts are part of a very well-designed and well-thought-out conservation strategy led by the Conservation Program using a cross-NOAA approach that takes full advantage of the agency's considerable scientific and management expertise. NOAA also works in close partnership with U.S. coral reef state and territorial agencies, academic and nonprofit partners throughout the Coral Reef Conservation Program. NOAA's theory of change for resilient reefs and successfully manage reefs includes strategies to address local threat reduction, for example, limiting nutrient and sediment pollution, and ending unsustainable fishing practices in order to improve water quality in coastal areas. We conduct research on coral reefs to inform and improve management actions. We conduct research to improve in-water coral restoration practices focused on resilient corals and maintaining ecosystem functions. We work closely with our partners to increase capacity at the local government and community levels. All of this is underpinned with what we call resilience-based management, that is, conservation actions and strategies designed to make sure corals can bounce back and recover from multiple stressors and threats across both short and long timescales. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jennifer. Now we'll open up the line to our first question.
Thank you. Our first question comes from Max Chestnut with Tampa Bay Times. Your line is open.
Hi there. Good afternoon. This is Max Chestnut here with Tampa Bay Times. In terms of quantifying the scale of the bleaching event happening now, is there a percentage value or perhaps a square mileage of just the sheer amount of coral that we are seeing that are either bleached now or will be bleached by the end of this event? And that is open to any expert. Thank you.
Is that something that you could handle, Derek, or?
Hey, Derek Menzel here. I mean, I can speak to the scale of the heat stress, but I unfortunately cannot speak to what is actually going on in the water.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any estimates like that, Andy, or is that something that's going to be part of a future analysis?
Yeah, so this is Andy Bruckner. I will try to answer that. So there's a whole series of monitoring that's going on throughout the Florida Reef Track, both in Southeast Florida, the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary, and the Dry Tortugas. We have something that's called Disturbance Response Monitoring Program. This is through, we have a program called the Florida Reef Resilience Program, and this was established prior to the 2014 bleaching event, where every year in August and September and October, we do surveys throughout the Florida Reef Track to get a sense of if bleaching occurs, when it first starts, what species are affected, how severe it is. Then based on the outcome of that, if we have a very bad year like this year, what we then do is we do follow-up cruises to reassess those sites in the winter or spring after the temperatures have cooled and the corals that survived have started to regain their color. And so we will go back this year and hit sites throughout Florida as well. Now, we don't look at every coral. What you have to do is you try to hit representative sites. We basically have a sampling strategy which subdivides all the reef system into different regions, different locations in terms of how close it is to shore, so near shore, mid-channel, offshore sites, and then specific reefs throughout that system, and we do representative transects. And so based on that, we can get a sense overall of the percent of the reefs that have bleached. But, I mean, I think because we're talking millions of corals, you'll never know how many, you know, the total number. You just have a sense of how severe that event is. And the last thing I just want to say about that is it's really, really important to remember that a coral can bleach and it can recover if the temperature cools down. And so what our hope is if this heat wave continues as long as what the predictions are, what Derek presented, it could be quite severe. But if we get lucky and we get a hurricane that comes through or some event that cools this down, those corals that right now are pale to bleached could potentially recover. And really, that's what the intent is of our winter springtime surveys is to get a better sense of what was the pattern of losses and how many of these corals survived and you know what sort of direction is the reef going in. And I hope that answers your question. Sorry, that was kind of long.
Thank you.
We're ready for our next question.
Our next question comes from Amy Green, Inside Climate News. Your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. Could you explain the bleaching process and the role of algae in that process of bleaching and death for the corals? I was going to ask the same question as Max, which is, you know, if you don't have data that can convey the scope or the scale of this calamity, anecdotally, could you paint a picture for readers and listeners, you know, illustrating the scope of this disaster for the corals?
Ian, why don't you start with that question?
Yeah, certainly. I'll address the first part. So it's important when you look at a photo of a coral to understand that it's not just the coral animal. It's actually a whole bunch of things living together. And most importantly, perhaps in that relationship, is the symbiosis or the direct relationship of the coral animal with an algae called zooxanthellae. And that zooxanthellae photosynthesizes just like plants do on land and in turn provides food to the coral animal. And so that relationship is really sensitive to temperature. So when waters get a bit too warm, that relationship breaks down and the algae leaves the coral. And the coral is ultimately compromised. So if this is why Andy was just speaking about, if this happens for too long, if it's bleached for too long, if it doesn't get other sources of nutrition, that it can ultimately lead to death. And I'll let someone else address the second
part of the question. Would you repeat that again, the second part of the question?
Like Max, I'm trying to get a sense of the scope or scale of the disaster, and if data is not available yet to illustrate that anecdotally, could you paint a picture for readers or listeners, you know, how widespread or what the scale of these losses are?
Derek or Andy, would you like to handle that one?
So I'll jump in quickly, and then maybe Derek can add a little bit to this. But
Andy Bruckner.
Yes, Andy Bruckner. So we know, within the Florida Keys anyways, we are seeing signs of bleaching pretty much everywhere throughout the reef system. We are trying to characterize how severe that is because, you know, as what I indicated before, colonies can start to bleach but not completely lose their pigmentation and they may not die. And so what our hope is by the time we finish our surveys in January, February, March timeframe, we will understand how many reefs were hit really hard and we had a lot of mortality versus those reef systems where they fared a little better and we have higher survival of individual corals, certain species, or certain genotypes. And so really by next spring, we will have a sense of how severe the impacts were from this event. But right now, other than the fact that we're seeing bleaching pretty much everywhere throughout all the reef system, we don't have a lot more information than that at this point in time.
Hey, Derek Manzella here. Two things. So the scale of this event is very alarming. So this started in the Eastern Tropical Pacific in early June, and we have confirmed reports of severe bleaching now from southern Mexico around Oaxaca all the way down through Colombia. So we're talking about thousands of miles of bleaching level heat stress with confirmed bleaching reports. And then things really started getting hot, severely hot in the Caribbean in about late June, early July. Again, and we have confirmed reports of bleaching from colleagues, partners, scientists in the field who are very well versed on this topic and providing us data from locations in Panama, Belize, Mexico, both sides of the Yucatan, Florida, the Bahamas, southeastern Cuba off Guantanamo Bay, and bleaching has already begun in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. So we're talking about thousands upon thousands of miles of coral reefs undergoing severe bleaching heat stress. And I do want to add one additional point to the mechanism and the response of corals to bleaching. So it is absolutely true that corals can recover from bleaching if temperatures decline soon enough and they're not exposed to heat stress for too long. But I do want to point out that there are lasting physiological impacts to the coral even when they are able to recover. So it has been very well documented at this point
that coral calcification rates decline, reproduction declines to the point where corals can become nearly sterile for upwards of 2 to 4 years after recovery from bleaching. Furthermore, corals become increasingly susceptible to disease after they go through a heat stress event. Now, one of the things Andy talked about was that disease levels were very, very high in Florida before this heat stress event even started. And this could potentially be due to the fact that there was a moderate to minor coral bleaching event that impacted the entirety of Florida's coral reef all the way from southeast Florida down through the Dry Tortugas last year. Now, mortality was low associated with that event, but it's potentially likely that the very high levels of disease that were observed before the bleaching started could have very well been a hangover from the thermal stress event that took place last year.
We'll take the next question when you're ready, operator.
Our next question comes from Allison Chinchar with CNN. Your line is open.
Hi there. So my question is for either expert, but it's really focused on slides 4 and 5 of the presentation today. I know the focus was really on Florida, but I noticed on both of those graphics that there are plenty of other alert level 2 areas globally. So my question is, what other countries or specific regions are of particular concern? And are there any other areas that have reached similar unprecedented levels like Florida has, but on a global standpoint?
We'll put that question over to Derek.
Yep. Thanks, Monica. So Derek Manzella here. So you're absolutely correct that so I will say that I believe Florida right now is experiencing the worst of it, but there are certainly other locations that are experiencing very extreme thermal stress. So off of southern Mexico, off of the Oaxaca area and the Huatulco heat reef tract, this site is experiencing heat stress that has never been experienced before. And I was on a call 2 days ago with members of the Global Coral Reef Monitoring Network for the Eastern Tropical Pacific, and they were discussing some very, very interesting phenomenon that they're seeing on these reefs. In particular, off Mexico, not only are the corals severely bleached, but they're also seeing other ecosystem impacts from this heat stress. One of the things that has been very noticeable to them is that sharks have disappeared. And the reason for this is because this is normally a higher productivity environment. And when you have an El Nino event, the thermocline gets very, very deep. So you have very low nutrients in the surface waters, and productivity goes way down. So the food sources for the sharks are going away. And also we need to consider the fact that when waters are warmer, there's less oxygen. The sharks, as we know, always need to be swimming around constantly because they have a high oxygen demand. So essentially what you have is a situation where sharks have moved out of these areas in the Mexican Pacific because it's basically just too hot for them. And the other thing they're reporting from Mexico, which is very interesting, is that a species of wrasse that's very common throughout the entire eastern Pacific from Mexico all the way to the Galapagos is currently starting to feed on bleached corals. And this is very weird because this species of wrasse in the genus Thalassoma normally is not a corallivore. Furthermore, there are certain species of sea stars that have totally disappeared from these reefs. So we need to also consider the fact that corals are not the only organisms that are suffering as a result of this heat. There are many other locations in the Eastern Pacific and the Caribbean that are experiencing extreme heat stress. For instance, the Eastern Pacific part of Panama is experiencing very extreme heat stress that it's never experienced before. Also off of the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, particularly on the western side of the Yucatan, they started seeing coral mortality taking place very early in, I believe it was June. And again, the reports that came in were the kind of things we've seen in the Keys and some of the Acroporas, and that they experienced rapid tissue loss. What this means is they got hit by such an acute heat shock that they skipped bleaching altogether, and their tissue just sloughed off and they died. So again, this heat stress event is spanning thousands of miles, and unfortunately, I believe it is just beginning, because all of the data we have at our disposal right now is suggesting that this event is going to become Caribbean-wide in the next days to weeks. And again, it's all going to depend on just how hot it gets in these locations and how long it lasts. And one of the main cooling mechanisms
that can happen to ameliorate these impacts would be hurricanes and tropical storms. But as of right now, the Atlantic Ocean has been pretty conspicuously silent in terms of development of hurricanes and tropical storms. So right now we are marching toward a Caribbean-wide event unless we have some very significant changes in weather patterns.
Thank you.
One quick question to follow up. Derek, you said a species of I wasn't sure what the species of that was feeding off the coral, and I didn't hear it well, but maybe others also didn't.
So this is a type of wrasse. It's spelled W-R-A-S-S. So these are small little fish. They're very common on coral reefs all over the world. And this particular species of wrasse in the eastern Pacific is really conspicuous all throughout the region. And normally it does not feed on coral, but for whatever reason, after this mass bleaching started taking place, our colleagues in Mexico are reporting that it has started to feed on coral tissues, which is a very interesting observation.
Thanks, Eric.
Our next question comes from Catherine Einhorn with the New York Times. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you so much for this. I guess we're hearing two things, right? We're hearing about this sort of terrifyingly unprecedented situation that corals are dealing with in Florida and perhaps more broadly. And, you know, we're also hearing about these Herculean efforts to, you know, continue restoring the Florida reef despite how, you know, degraded it already is. And, you know, I wonder if it would be easy for journalists to sort of take away, well, like, things are really bad, but, you know, we're doing all these things to make sure that it's going to be okay. And so kind of like you don't have to worry. And is that the takeaway that you want us to have? What's the takeaway that you want us to have?
So this is Andy Bruckner. I'll jump in first and other folks can add to this. And I'd say no, we do need to worry. We are conducting this restoration. We recognize that there's these stresses. When we planned Mission Iconic Reefs, we also knew that it's very likely that we are going to have some of these disturbances like this particular bleaching event or a hurricane, or there's a number of things that can cause setbacks in our progress of restoration. That said, we're not doing it in a vacuum. The whole key thing about Mission Iconic Reefs is that we are taking into account a lot of these other factors like this heat wave event and looking at strategies that we can you know, start implementing in our restoration to ensure that the corals are better able to adapt and tolerate the changing environmental conditions. We expected from day one that we would lose some of these corals, but as we're going along, we're learning and advancing. And so there's sort of two pieces here. One of them is that we have made an effort to ensure that we don't lose the genetic stock that we have. We've gone through and characterized what's remaining. We've characterized, you know, we're starting to characterize the biology and physiology of these corals and understand how within one species, there's individual genetic strains that have different tolerances to different sorts of stresses. There are certain ones that may be more tolerant to disease or resist disease. There are certain ones that can tolerate higher temperatures. And, you know, there's a lot more to it than that, the symbionts that Ian was mentioning and everything else. And so the whole intent here is that we're trying to protect the genetic resources that we have, put them back on the reef, but do other actions at the same time so that we improve the overall condition of that reef system. So we have a whole other management plan that we're currently working on revising to, you know, look at things like water quality and the other stresses that are affecting these corals. So we know that, you know, overall, we need to, as a global society, address CO2 emissions. But what we're really trying to do is we're more or less buying time, and we're trying to build a self-sustaining reef by putting more of these corals that can better tolerate these changes out onto the reef system.
This is Ian Enox. If I can add to that, please. I would say that myself and my colleagues have become, you know, quite calloused to stress on coral reefs, unfortunately, because we've seen, unfortunately, decline in the health of these ecosystems. But speaking with many of them, as I have over the last several weeks, we are all quite concerned and worried and stressed about this event because it is happening earlier and at more extreme extreme temperatures than we have been used to seeing. Going to that site, which I said I've been going to for more than 10 years, and seeing literally everything bleached is not a normal thing, and it affects, you know, all of us. To your point, I would say that, you know, people that are involved with restoration and from developing these technologies and to working on all of these things are some of the most committed and hardworking and passionate people that I've ever met, and are doing as much as they can. But none of them think that they are absolutely doing enough and have this entirely solved. It is really clear that we need to keep doing what we're doing, but do it more of it. Do it at a bigger scale if we're really hoping to try to address the scale of the problem as we're seeing it unfold. Thank you.
Hey, this is Derek Manzola. I'd like to jump in and just add a little bit to that. So one of the things that concerns me right now, so as Andy mentioned, we're learning a heck of a lot right now as this is unfolding. And the Herculean effort by state, local, and federal government and non-governmental organizations in Florida has been awe-inspiring. I mean, I've been just in awe of what has taken place. But as this continues and, you know, it starts spreading throughout the Caribbean, one of my big concerns right now is we don't have the resources in place to fully document what is going to happen and what we're going to lose and how we're going to lose it. And what I mean by that is we don't have the resources to do the surveys at the level of resolution that we need to go out and get before data points, during event data points, and post-event data points. And the reason that's so crucial is because with that information, then we will be able to know exactly what species die first from the heat, what species can survive the heat, what species might be able to survive the heat, but then they go on to die from disease. And all of this information is vital if we really hope to make a dent in restoring the coral reefs of the Florida Keys. I mean, we really, really need this information. And, you know, we right now there's just no funding in the entire world to gather the information we need to really document what is lost, how it's lost, and what is actually really killing the corals. Is it the heat directly? Is it secondary infections and coral disease? I mean, all of this information can be utilized by restoration practitioners. You know, for instance, during the next bleaching event, if they had all that information, they would know, okay, species A, we got to get that out of the water right now. However, species B is probably going to survive, but we need to do something to ameliorate any increased disease risk for that species moving forward. So these are the kind of things that need to be done. And unfortunately, we're going to have a huge information bottleneck, and we're just not going to be able to gather enough information to understand what is truly being lost and how it's being lost as a result of the heat stress event. And this is, you know, evidenced by the fact of what we've seen in the Keys so far. A lot of the staghorn and elkhorn corals, where it's been the hottest, have experienced rapid tissue loss. They haven't even bleached. They just died. And the other thing that's happened in Florida that's really shocking to me is that a lot of places, soft corals have just immediately died. Now, and throughout the entire Caribbean, soft corals up until now have been a winner. Their populations have either been sustained or have actually increased throughout the entire Caribbean as the hard corals have declined. So I was completely shocked by the fact that soft corals essentially just were dropping dead in Florida as a result of this heat shock. So, you know, just to kind of wrap it all up, my soapbox speech here is that the resources we need to really do our jobs and to really put a dent in the climate crisis that is impacting coral reefs, we just don't have them right now, and it's really unfortunate.
This is Jennifer Koss. I'd love to jump in, too, and just say that I echo everything that everyone has said before. It is devastating. People are anxious. They're depressed, but at the same time, they're pitching in and doing everything that they can because we all know this is not a resource we can afford to lose. We cannot, full stop, afford to lose coral reefs. The ecosystem and societal values that they provide to coastal communities, particularly Florida along the southeast and in the Keys, is critical to sustaining economies and the safety of the people that live there. So as horrible as it is, we're in it and we're going to fight to the death, figure out how to make sure corals can buy enough time to withstand this event.
Is it possible for me to just ask one quick follow-up question?
We've got quite a few questions still waiting, and we're kind of
okay. You can come back to me at the end if there's
you
time.
Can. Yeah, and also we can help you later too.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Jenny Stolidovich with WLRN. Your line is open.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yes.
You can hear me?
Yep.
I can hear you.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. So sorry about that. So my question goes back to the scale of the problem, and Derek might be able to answer this, which is, you know, we've had 8 bleaching events about in Florida. You talk about this being Caribbean-wide, 7 in the Pacific, 5 in the Atlantic. Has that ever happened before? And how would you measure this compared to past events that were broad enough to cover, you know, the whole system? And then sort of the second part of that is, we know things don't stay put in the ocean. So if you start losing reefs all around the system, what happens?
Great question. So one of the things that I think maybe people fail to realize is that mass coral bleaching driven by climate change has been impacting coral reefs for 4 years. The first mass coral bleaching event that took place that impacted an entire region happened during the 1982-83 El Nino event in the eastern tropical Pacific. Coral reefs were impacted from Mexico down to Panama, Colombia, and through the Galapagos Islands. There was about 75% mortality in Panama for the corals, but in the Galapagos, there was about 95 to 99% mortality, and the mortality was so great that all the branching coral postoloperative reef structures in the Galapagos were rapidly bioeroded and completely lost in about 10 years' time. Now, since this first mass coral bleaching event took place 40 years ago in the eastern Pacific, what we have seen throughout the world is that coral bleaching has increased in severity, magnitude, and duration. In 1998, we experienced our first global coral bleaching event, which means corals bleached in the Indian, Pacific, and Caribbean seas. Since then, we've experienced 2 more global bleaching events. There was a global bleaching event in 2010. The most severe global bleaching event took place in 2014 through 2017. And this, again, was on the back of a very strong El Nino. So what is concerning us now is that, again, we are right on the cusp of a very strong El Nino. And what is happening right now is exactly what happened during the last global bleaching event. Now, it's still way too early to predict whether or not there will be a global bleaching event. But if we compare what is happening right now to what happened in the beginning of the past global bleaching event, things are worse now than they were in 2014 to 2017. And to put the 2014-2017 event into context, more than 75% of the world's coral reefs experienced bleaching level heat stress, and more than half of the world's coral reefs experienced multiple bleaching events. So there is a big concern among the coral reef science community right now that we are potentially walking into another global bleaching event based on what we know and what history has taught us in the past. So this is a very serious event. And again, Florida is just the tip of the iceberg. So, you know, as things progress, we're very closely monitoring what is happening throughout the world's oceans. Because again, as I said, Florida is just the tip of the iceberg.
Thank you. And can you talk a little bit about what would be lost if these reefs start to collapse?
You know, we're going to have to move to we've got a few more questions.
Okay,
we're going to try to take all the questions we have right now, and then we're going to, if you want to do further interviews, you can get in touch with me or my colleagues, and we'll try to set something up for you. So, operator, please take the next questions, and we'll go to hear from those folks who've been waiting.
Certainly. Our next question comes from Alex Harris with the Miami Herald. Your line is open.
Hi there. I was wondering if you could share more about the pilot shading programs and if that's a scalable idea for all of the Southeast Florida and the Keys reefs, or if it only works in some scenarios, and how much, if you know, degree difference does that make?
So, I mean, I can. This is Andy Bruckner. I will start on that, and other folks can jump in on this. So shading has been is something we use all the time. For instance, on land-based coral production facilities, basically to keep down the amount of light. And so we know that it's a critical piece. It's not necessarily intended to reduce the temperature in that area. It's actually trying to reduce the amount of light, because what we've seen is when these corals are exposed to really high temperature stress, if there is a compounding impact from high light level, that tends to make bleaching much more severe. That said, we know that shading works the best if you get out there and shade corals early in the event. So when you have maybe 3 to 6 degree heating weeks, it's been shown to be very effective in some small-scale pilots that have been tried on the Great Barrier Reef and in a few other locations, and it's been used in coral nurseries very, very effectively. We also do know that when corals do bleach, when you shade them and if you supplement them then with food and things like that, that can actually make them recover quickly. In terms of scalability of this, there's a lot of challenges to doing this, and all we're trying to do this year is really just to demonstrate proof of concept, because it really hasn't been tried a lot on the reefs. It's been used more in confined areas like coral nurseries. And so our intent is just to try to find suitable materials to figure out different ways to deploy it, and then to start measuring how these different materials affect the amount of light and the temperature underneath those areas. We'd love to scale this up, but any of these interventions, you have to remember that they're really challenging. And so realistically, where I see where we could go with shading is for certain really high-value areas. You would potentially be able to shade those in an event like this, but not the entire reef system.
Next question, please, operator.
Certainly. Our next question comes from Tim O'Hara with the Key West Citizen. Your line is open.
My first question, I just would like to ask two fairly quick questions, I would think. My first one's for Andy. About a year ago, Andy, you said at a Sanctuary Advisory Council meeting when they kicked off the Restoration Blueprint that this, the Keys Reef is at a tipping point, and it could be the first major U.S. ecosystem to collapse this century. Have we surpassed that tipping point, and are we seeing that collapse now, do you think? And then also, you guys were talking about funding. There's been a huge effort put into, moving corals to deeper water, shading, all of these things. What is the government doing federally and state to sort of pitch in here? Like, how much is this cost, let's say, moat and reef renewal, the sanctuary, and moving all of this stuff and doing it? Do you have any costs on that? And are any requests in right now to the federal government to bring extra funding into the sanctuary itself or into grants to help to help cover all of these costs that a lot of it are being borne out of pocket by the sanctuary and the local groups?
Okay. This is Andy Bruckner. I'll try to answer that. And so, yes, I mean, I still think that we are near a tipping point, and how this event unfolds will tell us a little more we're there, but I still don't think that it's too late. I mean, I think that as long as we take the actions we have, we've demonstrated over the last 3 years that in some of the sites, we've been very, very successful at restoring the coral. And prior to this event, we had areas where there were thickets of elkhorn coral and staghorn coral, again, that had been reestablished, and we were starting to see some of the other community members coming back in those spots. And so given where our technology is and everything that we've done, as well as the new measures we're proposing in our restoration blueprint to address sort of other stresses that are affecting these reefs, I think that, as long as we really dedicate a lot of efforts and we continue to make progress here, that we still have a while before we would say that these reefs are too far gone, that they won't come back. In terms of the funding, I can't provide you with exact dollar amounts, but what I can tell you is this whole rescue effort has been a collaborative effort. So each of the restoration practitioners are focusing on their corals, and we've brought in other folks, both the sanctuary, divers from our buoy team and our science team have been out with them, helping them set up new ropes, move the corals onto land to establish new sort of moorings and doing a lot of that work. And then the other really positive thing is through NOAA's Coral Reef Conservation Program, and I think Jen Cost can probably speak more about this, but there's some NIFWIF emergency funding that's coming out to support the efforts that all of the practitioners and our partners are doing to help support the costs of moving these corals, the infrastructure needs. You know, there's other costs as well. You have maintenance costs once they're on land. You need people that are good in husbandry to take care of the corals. And so, yes, the federal government is providing a lot of funding for that. I just don't know because it's too early yet. We really don't know what the costs are.
Thanks, Andy. We'll go to our last question.
Our final question comes from Kat Clifford with CNBC. Your line is open.
Hi, can you hear me?
We hear you fine, yep.
Okay, super. Thank you so much. So outside of the inherent importance of, you know, the biodiversity and keeping these coral reefs alive, can you speak to the implications of why coral reefs are important? Sort of putting the, you know, importance of every creature and such aside, which I recognize. But, you know, what are the other implications? What are the cascading implications? Why is it so important to keep these coral reefs alive? Thank you.
I can take this one. This is Ian Enox. I think it's really important to recognize you're speaking to some NOAA scientists here, which we are all within the Department of Commerce. So we can be really clear about all of the ecosystem services, all the economic benefits, all the commerce that coral reefs support. So coral reefs are obviously support fisheries and food to coastal economies, and also recreation. So there's scuba divers, that people go out to reefs to go fishing, and also all the other things that are associated with that as well, hotels, restaurants, whatnot. Reefs are also really important for buffering storm energy and hurricane wave action that would otherwise pummel our shorelines and our coastal infrastructure. They are living walls that break that energy from hitting our shores. And so maybe Andy has the number better than I do, but I know that billions of dollars of economic value are ascribed to coral reefs throughout the Keys on a yearly basis. And if we look, you know, wider throughout reefs, throughout the Caribbean and throughout, you know, the rest of the world, it's incredibly high value from all of these different ecosystem services. So there are a whole bunch of economic benefits, but that's really not the only thing. I really want to come back to that just inherent, absolutely amazing value of just all of the different species and beauty that these natural ecosystems provide. And that really cannot be discounted as well.
Thank you so much, Andy, and thank you so much, Ian, and thank you so much, Andy, and thank you so much, Derek, for your great answers, and Jennifer Koss as well. We have no further questions, and we're going to wrap up the call. First, I'd like to also thank all the journalists who hung in there for the little extra bit so we could get everyone's questions in, and then also to Steve Thur and all our speakers. Because the coral event is ongoing and NOAA's mission, Iconic Reefs, is currently doing an assessment, we look forward to keeping the media updated when we have those assessment results and other info to share. Also, I encourage you to go to research.noaa.gov for a story for media resources, including photos, videos, and stories, and lots of background that you can use in your stories. Lastly, an audio file of this call will be posted on NOAA.gov, the NOAA.gov Media Advisory, and on that resource page on research.noaa.gov later today. If you have any further questions or you need more interviews, please email me at monica.allen@noaa.gov or my colleagues, Catherine.Silverstein@noaa.gov or nesdes.pa.noaa.gov. Thank you very much.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect your lines at this time.